I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's very nice to be here. So yes, the title of my talk is Topological Defects in Gauge Theories, and this is based on joint work with Robert Gerard, also from Toronto. So we would like to introduce the problem. So the goal is we would like to describe dynamics of solutions of wave equations that arise from gauge theory. So heuristically, as a we can write it in a simple way as Bach's, which corresponds to a wave operator, which could be either just depending on regular derivatives or covariant derivatives. If we have just regular derivatives, then A would be equal to zero, and then we'll have some nonlinearity, or we can say a potential V of U, and then we have an epsilon, which is a small parameter. So we would like to couple this equation to electromagnetic fields, and that can result either in an abelian Higgs model or the Young-Mills Higgs. So what's the motivation to study this? Well, there's a lot of it, but one that we would like to focus on is the motivation coming from cosmology, and then there are parallel results that are established in the elliptic and parabolic PDE, so the motivation is also mathematical. Could we do what was done for a hyperbolic equation as well? Okay. So now some background coming from cosmology. So we're going to start just like this morning with Einstein's equation, and let's look at the right-hand side where we have a stress-energy tensor that corresponds to matter field U. And the equation many times has a form of the nonlinear wave equation that we had on the first slide. So if some cosmologists might be interested in studying the equation for U, and what they do is they might make a specific choice for the metric G, and that can result in many different nonlinear waves. Okay, so when you study those equations, you can end up with predictions and speculations about many different things, and here's just a list of some of them. So we can talk about dynamics of cosmic strings and domain walls. And within cosmic strings, you can talk about collisions, radiation, scattering, and then you can have exotic cosmic strings, superconducting, non-abelian, fermionic. You can also have decay of a false vacuum, cosmic strings formation, the early universe, any of the above coupled to Einstein's equation, and the ekpyrotic universe, and then many others. Okay, so now, right now the goal is, so again, we're looking at a wave equation with some potential, and we would like to couple it to electromagnetic field. And the title, I said that we're going to talk about topological defects. So I would like to explain what I mean by that. So we're going to motivate the concept of a topological defect. So here we have a motivation. So we're going to start with a simple model for a wave equation where you have, okay, so here's V and U. V is supposed to be U or U is supposed to be V. That's supposed to be the same thing. So you take an inner product and you sum up with respect to alpha. So alpha means that we're summing up with respect to zero and then all the way to the spatial, the last spatial component n, and the zero component corresponds to time. And here phi, so let's stick with phi. Phi will be a map from Rn plus 1 to Rk, and we're assuming k is strictly less than n. And we're choosing specific potential V to be the Mexican hat potential. Okay, so now you can compute the corresponding Euler Lagrange equations, you'll get a wave equation. And we make an observation that if you have a point in Rk such that V of P is equal to zero, then you can actually observe that P equal to that P is a solution. So we make a definition that the set of all points such that V of P is equal to zero, we're going to call that M or vacuum manifold. So V of P is vanishing. If V vanishes in P, at P then the set of all these points is called the vacuum manifold. Okay, so we have a definition of vacuum manifold. Now let's look at some examples. So now we're letting K equal to be one. So I have U again, okay. So U is a map now from R3 plus 1 to R, and we're sticking with the same potential. So if we're just mapping to R, then the vacuum manifold is very simple. It's just a set of 2 points, -1 and +1. So then we can look for a specific solution, and we can just say, let's choose Q, where Q is just depending on one variable. And one can actually plug this in and solve it and obtain a hyperbolic tangent. And observation is the Q will connect that 2 points. Will go from -1 to +1. And this construction can actually lead to something called the domain wall. So that's one example when the vacuum manifold is disconnected. But now let's look at another example when we have k is equal to 2, and we're still mapping from 3 plus 1, but now we're mapping to R2. So in this case, we will have that the vacuum manifold is circled as 1. So again, we can look for specific solutions, and this will lead to cosmic string. So domain wall strings and domain wall strings are two examples of topological defects. So now let's make this a little bit more precise. Why are they called topological? So from the examples, you can see that the topology of the vacuum manifold can influence the type of the solution we might see, and Kibble classified the corresponding defects, sometimes called domain structures using homotopy groups. So pi 0 will correspond to domain walls, pi 1 will correspond to strings, pi 2 to monopoles, and pi 3 to something called textures. So for the rest of this talk, we would like to focus our attention on strings. Okay, so some more stories about cosmic strings. So Kibble, in the paper, argues that the universe is correctly described by a spontaneous Brocken gauge theory, and then further assumes that in its very early history, the universe was above some critical temperature. And the idea is that as the universe cools, the defects are frozen in, and then they propagate. And also he makes a comment that the domain walls are considered unlikely, that if they existed, we probably would have seen them. And then there are some statements about the cosmic strings that they're considered more likely to exist. So this was, I said, 1976. And then subsequent works try to predict the current distribution of cosmic strings in the universe, possible observational implications. And then there were several models of distribution of cosmic strings in the early universe, large-scale simulations of cosmic string evolution over very large time and length scales, and then models for cosmic string radiation dissipation, and many, many other stuff. So what's interesting is that there's a lot of rigorous results that, due to the time constraints, I'm not even going to list, but I had 3 slides that I ended up cutting out. But there's a lot of stuff about elliptic and parabolic analogs of the questions that can be phrased not in the hyperbolic setting, but in the elliptic and parabolic. And there's not that many rigorous results about the hyperbolic setting. So we're actually going to be interested in one specific idea. So the idea that we're interested is that, the general expectation is that one can find initial data such that if you look at your solution to the equation NLW, which could have different forms again, then the energy of the solution will concentrate on sets evolving approximately via the equation for time-like Minkowski minimal surface. So that's the expectation. So, okay, so here I have some background on time-like minimal surfaces we talked about in this morning. As an analyst, I do care about these things too. So there's a work of Milbrett and then Dagu-Muller to talk about local time existence of small time-like minimal surfaces, which we, in this work, we do care. We do want them to make sure that they exist at least for some time t. So the idea is, again, you have some equation, and claim is that the energy of that, of the solution, not for all solutions, but you could cook up some data that the energy of that solution will be concentrating on sets that follow timeline Minkowski minimal surface. So so one equation that we'll be interested in is the, well, we're interested in many different ones, but let's start with the simpler one. So let's look at the Boolean Higgs model. So so here we have, no, we have finally P. So we have P, we'll be mapping from Rn plus 1 to complex numbers, and you have connection A alpha, which is real valued, and then you can define the covariant derivative as follows, and then talk about the curvature. This is abelian, so there's no brackets. And now we have a corresponding Lagrangian. So before we just had this term with regular derivatives, now we have a covariant derivative. The inner product we're imposing is with the bar here. Now, so we're summing up, well, raising the indices with the Minkowski metric. And then we have our potential as before. So here's our Lagrangian. Okay, so here's the Boolean Higgs model, and now I would like to give some background. What's known about the previous question about the energy of solutions following minimal surface? So here's the Boolean Higgs model now. Okay, so one result, I believe it's the only one that I'm, well, it's the only one that I'm aware of for the Boolean Higgs model that's rigorous, by Gustafson and Siegel from 2008, and that one considers when you have point defects, so you're not looking at submanifolds, you're looking at just points. Then observe that in the other works, and basically this is all the work that we are aware of at this point for the hyperbolic setting. So like I said, for the elliptic and parabolic, there were three slides full of stuff, and now here is several results. And if you observe the other equations, there's no covariant derivative, just regular derivatives. So there's some work of Stewart, then we have Picagna, Velatine, Vaga, Orlandi, and then work of Gerard, and this is what we're actually, what's inspiring the current work on the Abelian Higgs. So Bob had some very nice results. So for submanifolds of dimension, of codimension 1 and 2, and he showed that yes, that that the solutions do in fact exhibit concentration sets that follow your minimal surface. Okay, so here's a theorem that I would like to talk about, and so this is very recent, and it's, well, I guess we still didn't, this, we still have to put all the details together, but we are 100% sure this should be true. So what does the theorem say? So we're looking at a very specific case. We're choosing codimension 2 for our minimal surface, and we're mapping from R3, okay? And so we're giving initial velocity of gamma zero, and this is actually, one could give it some velocity, but it's a technical thing that right now we didn't want to deal with. Okay, and then we have, we say that there exists some time that's independent of epsilon, and then we have a solution, and we're looking at the critical case, and I'll explain that shortly why we're looking at the critical case. So the lambda here, that's coming from the potential. And here is basically the statement right here tells us that the energy is concentrating near the minimal surface. So what is this saying? So if we have our time-like minimal surface and fix freeze time, so fix t equals to t naught, and we're looking, so this is codimension 2, and the picture is, well, in R4, but, well, you can picture. So it's this, so at T equals T naught, you'll just have a string. And the idea is that now if we slice and look at, so we're slicing, and you will see a vortex. You will see a vortex. So you slice, and then you have a two-dimensional slice, and within that slice, you will see a vortex. And the idea is that your energy for your solution is going to be concentrated nearby your gamma T at T equals naught, T naught. And as epsilon will go to zero, it actually will be pushed onto the string. Okay, so that's the statement of the result. And now let me talk about a little bit what are the main ingredients of the proof. Okay, so there are three big parts. So one is a change of variable, which is a very nice change of variables where you take the equation and you write it in a frame that follows your time-like minimal surface. Then the next step is energy estimates. So you do energy estimates and then you have coordinates, and you obtain something which some people might not like because the energy is supposed to be conserved, and all of a sudden we're talking about approximately conserved energy. But the idea is that we want the approximate part because the extra term that's left over is actually a good term that we like. It's giving us good estimates. And then there's something called defect confinement. That's we want some sort of functional that can determine if our vortex is staying nearby the minimal surface. So there are three ingredients, and let's talk about them in a little bit more detail. So the change of variables. So let's skip what the definition of the change of variables is for this specific case. Let's just look at what would the equations look like. So the top part here, there's nothing exciting happening. This is how it would look like if you look in any metric. So the thing that we're doing a little bit different is we're just writing this out. So this is exactly equivalent to this part here, and then you have this advection term that we do like, and you'll see in a second why. So we like this term, and then we have, this is part that you would have if you just had a Minkowski metric, and then you have some additional stuff here. And this is your current. Okay, so this is how the equations look like in these new coordinates, and we work with these two. Okay, so the nice thing you see about why we like to write it out like this here is because this term and this one here is similar to it, has nice properties. Okay, and this is actually the only, so this is a lemma Bob proved in his previous paper that says that the advection term is bounded by the here, so we mean the tangential covariant derivative. And here we have the normal covariant derivative. And this, again, gives us something, implies good energy estimate for solutions. And this is the only place in the argument that we're using if we're working with a minimal surface. Okay, so now energy estimates. So here's your standard energy densities, nothing special about it. The thing that we're doing, here we're writing A alpha beta, A alpha beta matrix is coming from the G alpha beta before we, never mind how it's written, but if you look at it, it looks like your standard energy density. And then you can show that you can rewrite this, and if you differentiate this in time, you can say that this is pointwise, that you can isolate certain terms. So here you'll have your covariance and tangential derivatives. Then there's part of the curvature that only has tangential components, and this one will actually have normal and some tangentials. But we don't care. It's fine that it's there. Okay, and this is the standard term that you would have if you were doing anything else here, the divergence part. Okay, so we have this lemma. Then another part is, and this is actually very interesting, is that at some point we need lower energy bounds in the normal variables. So the normal variable, since we're doing k equals to 2, forces us to consider a 2D problem. So there's tons. So observe, there's no time. This is a 2D problem, so there's tons of literature on this, especially in Ginsburg-Landau. However, their scaling is a little bit different, so one can look at the literature and get very excited and think that you can use their results, but no, you can't always do it. So what's the idea? In 2D, in the critical case, that's why right now we have a result only for the critical case. In the critical case, would be equal to 1. There's a very pretty awesome observation of Bogomolnay that you can take this energy density and rewrite it. And so actually, I guess most of the sources, they integrate it by parts and they write it as, they integrate it by parts and then they eliminate some terms and they write it, they integrate it. But the cool thing about this is that this actually holds point-wise. And so this is, you don't do anything. Just write it out. There's no integration by parts, okay? Maybe some product or whatever, I suppose, equivalent. But the nice thing is this holds point-wise, and if you look here, in the critical case, this term will go away. And actually, again, you might think, and I guess this is one thing that right now it still bothers me, because this term is positive for lambda bigger than 1, so somehow it seems to me that whatever we've done for the critical case should carry over to when lambda will be bigger than 1, since this is positive and shouldn't be hurting us, but it's not obvious, actually. It's hopeful. But anyway, the other terms here, this is positive. And, okay, so we like this term here, and then we like that term. Why do we like them? Because, well, okay, you can throw away the positive terms, and then again we have the lambda minus 1, so we can throw that away also, and in the critical case it will be gone. So you get a nice lower bound by the curl of the magnetic of the current, and then you have your curvature or the curl of A and 2D. Okay, so I guess one thing is that maybe it's, I should point out is that you could think, why do you here, why are you so worried about the lower bound? Because of the, what happens here. If you look here, so the critical case is very well studied, and there's a very awesome reference of Jaffe and Taubes for this. And so the identity that we had leads to, together with the quantization, the magnetic charge leads to global minimizers of the energy function among fields of the fixed degree M. So you can show that the energy is bounded by 2 pi m. This is the absolute value of the binding number of solution P. So, well, you have this result. So you say, okay, so I have the global minimizer, so that should imply the lower bounds. But one thing that's what's happening is that when we look at the normal part of the equation, we at this point we don't know if it solves the problem in 2D. It solves the bigger one on 3 plus 1, but at this point, when you just look at the normal components, you don't know that it's a solution, so you don't know a priori that you have those lower bounds. But since you have this nice property in the critical case, you have these global minimizers, that allows us to conclude very nice stuff. So here, yes, this leads us to the introduction of the defect confinement. So this is the quantity that we would like to work for us and detect if our vortex is staying close to the minimal surface. So we put in here 2 pi, so this is right now down for simplicity, but you could replace it by 2 pi m, where m, again, is the degree from before. So, okay, so now the last two parts are two lemmas. The one proves that if the defect of confinement is small, then actually you do have lower energy bounds. And then the nice thing, actually this relies on that lemma also, is that you can that you have a nice stability of your defect confinement that's controlled by the energy here. So you put all this together and then you obtain the result. So again, I'm not really sure. This is just a sketch of the proof. But so that's the last slide, but let me just make a couple of comments that, again, so this is done in the critical case, but it would be nice to extend it to other values of lambda. And what I really am interested in is to go into the non-abelian world and see how things work out there. But I suppose that will be the next step. So that's all I have. Thank you. Yes. You say something about what? So there's that lemma that gives you the nice properties here for this extra term that, yes, that leads to many, shows up everywhere, and it gives, we do use it, yes, but the point is to prove the lemma, we use the fact that we have the minimal. Yes. So by only in one place, we meant that at that point, to prove the lemma, we only used that there was a time-like minimal surface at that point only. But lemmas use everywhere.